This is the community calendar for Friday, February 27th, the 58th day of 2009. Nautical twilight starts at 5:48 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, with sunrise at 6:52. The midday sun transit is at 12:23 p.m. Sunset occurs at 5:55 p.m., with nautical twilight ending at 6:59. The waxing crescent moon rises at 7:37 a.m., transits at 12:22 p.m., setting at 9:22 p.m. The first quarter of the crow moon is at 11:46 p.m. Tuesday. Food Not Bombs is a social movement sharing free vegetarian food with everyday people as a response to the artificially created socioeconomic conditions that lead to poverty, war, and societal distress. Meals are served at 5:30 p.m., Fridays in Colonel Summers Park at Southeast 17th and Taylor, Saturdays under the west end of the Burnside Bridge, Sundays are under the west end of the Morrison Bridge, Mondays are at Peninsula Park Rose Garden at North Albina in Ainsworth. For more information, email pdxfnb@lists.riseup.net or go to foodnotbombs.net.
Man, it kills me. You know what? I know exactly why that is, because I played that thing so much, I tore it up. This is Pat McGuire, and Todd was trying to work some magic on that CD in there, but I fear I must have broken it. This is Boneheads and Bigots, and today we have a special guest with us. It's Seneca the Librarian, but first I have to announce that we're moving to a new time. That's right, beginning in March, which is next week, in case you've lost your way on the calendar. Many of our KBOO weekday programs that are on between 9 o'clock and noon are going to be moving to some new times. So this show, Boneheads and Bigots, will be moving to the third Friday of the month, and we're going to be on at 11 a.m. So I'm going to be back on Friday, March the 20th, and we're going to be on from 11 to 11:30. Don't miss me, because if you miss me, you will feel bad. You'll feel bad. Your skin will lose that glow. Your hair might start falling out. You might suffer some queasiness in your stomach if you don't hear me. So again, remember, Friday, March the 20th at 11 o'clock a.m. And Seneca's going to be coming with me, too, because I'm going to drag him wherever I go. And I forgot to ask Todd if Todd would be there with me, but I'm going to ask him later on if Todd would be there with me. Todd, if I move to a different time, will you still be my producer boyfriend?
As long as it's still on Friday mornings.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, yay. Okay, so we have the whole community coming with us. That means you too. Okay, so anyway, that was Raphael Sadiq that I was trying to play before, or that Todd was trying to clean up for me. And I wanted to let you guys know that he's coming to town Friday, March the 6th. He's going to be playing at the Wonder. And you guys go way back. If you remember Tony, he used to sing with them. He wrote and produced many of the songs that was on D'Angelo's Voodoo CD that came out many years ago. Whatever happened to D'Angelo? That's so sad. But anyway, Raphael Sadiq, amazing performer, amazing singer, March the 6th at the Wonder. Got to go see it. And before we get started, I want to give a shout out to my friend Paul, who is getting ready to go on a whirlwind tour of the experience of a lifetime. And also to my dear friend Josh, who is the tour of a lifetime in and of himself. So, moving on from there, Seneca, don't laugh at me. That was a shout out. It was heartfelt. We have, of course, some exciting books. And Seneca always has the best books. And now, right now, every time you show up, Seneca, there is a book that I want to actually take home with me and try to steal from the library. And I would never steal from the library. But the minute you took it out of your bag today, I was like, oh, I need that book so bad.
It's a nice book.
Seriously, nice. Seneca, you're like, first taste is free of the library books. So tell us about this book.
Well, Pat, this book is called Hip Hop Files, Photographs 1979 to 1984.
Don't you wish right now that radio had video with it?
Yes, indeed. This is a book from Martha Cooper, and she was one of, if not the premier photographer of the burgeoning hip-hop culture in New York City in 1979 to 84. And basically, I forget which newspaper she was working for, but the newspaper was located in an area where when she, I think it maybe was in the Bronx, and when she was walking back at the end of the day to finish off her rolls, she'd take a few shots of what's happening in the neighborhood. And one day she saw a kid, I don't know, 8 years old, who was what we call tagging now. You know, he spraying.
That's what we call it.
Right. Spraying graffiti.
What you people might know as tagging.
The kids today call tagging. Well, back in the day, she was like, well, that's really interesting. And he's like, well, do you want to meet a graffiti superstar? And she's like, what? And that was her intro to the culture. The next day, took her to this guy who was like the guy in the community and showed her the whole underground world of going to the train yards and spray painting these trains. And she started taking photographs of this kind of stuff. And of course, back then it was like, well, what are these photos? Why do you want us to publish them, mm-hmm. et cetera? But now they're just an amazing look at that time period. And you see these kids, 8, 10 years old, who are dressed like, you know, hipsters you see in town with their Adidas.
The Shelto Adidas.
Yeah, the Adidas clothing and the, I mean, this picture, I know you can't see it, but it's amazing. This tiny little room where they're drawing out their sketches before they go out.
I will describe this to you. It's people in a rec room and they have some fat Sharpies. Oh, fat Sharpies alone I lust after with some old school stereo equipment.
Check out that boombox.
Drinking some 40s, listening to a boombox. Got some Pumas, some bright blue Pumas with orange, fat orange laces. And they're working on their sketch pads. And one dude has, I swear to God, he's got some Stacey Adams on. Seriously, Seneca, I am going to steal this book today. And it's produced by, or it says Zeb Rocksky. Producer presents Martha Cooper's Hip Hop Files. It's photographs in 1979 to 84. Man, this is amazing because it's got pictures of Fab Five Freddy. Y'all remember him? Blade, Rocksteady Crew, Grandmaster Caz. And Grandmaster Caz, as you all know, he's the one that actually wrote the lyrics to many of the Sugar Hill Gang songs. Lady Pink, Run DMC, Ramelzy. Oh, I remember Ramelzy. That's like the Wayback Machine in pictures.
Yeah, it's just really incredible. I mean, look at these kids on a piece of cardboard in their, you know, playground.
I know.
And they all have the high socks up to their knees with the three colors at the top.
Seriously. If you can find those tube socks now, buy every pair that you can get in that six pack.
Right.
But this is amazing. I know it's frustrating for you because we are trying to describe photographs over the radio. It must be similar to every art show on the radio must drive people crazy when they try to talk
exactly.
about what paintings look like. This is an amazing looking book.
She has another book that's one of the most popular books in the art world called mm-hmm. Subway Art. Mm-hmm. And it was published in the early 80s and it's been through many editions. Mm-hmm. And all it is collections of trains from back then, because she would set up in a certain area. They'd tell her there's been some new trains painted overnight, and mm-hmm. she set up in a certain area where she could get the whole train as it's traveling
wow.
through the Bronx.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so she'd wait, because some of these things would get painted over fairly quickly.
Right, with the whole, like, keep graffiti down, that's the first sign of urban decay.
Exactly.
And wow.
Yeah, this one, Dondi. Dondi mm-hmm. was the graffiti superstar who she was first introduced
to. That's amazing. Wow, that's cool. That reminds me of another book that's sort of like that, which is Yes, Yes, Y'all. And that was an oral history of hip-hop. And that came out a couple years ago along with an accompanying exhibit up at the Experience Music Project up in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And they were playing they would normally do a short, you know, they edit down to maybe 4 or 5 minutes of video with all of the art exhibits there. And they took all of this video where they were speaking to Grandmaster Caz, and they were speaking to graffiti artists, and they were talking to the Treacherous Three and all of these people who were really early hip hop. And the staff there was so excited by the videos themselves that they mm-hmm. didn't edit it down. And so it was this continuous, like, 45-minute loop that kept playing.
That's neat.
While you're there. And then they had, along with it, some of the really old homemade posters that people were making for shows. And then some of the costumes. Like, they had some Afrika Bambaataa costumes from way back in the day. And they're just as crazy
yeah.
as they look. Remember on the videos? Remember when you used to have the video for Planet Rock? Wow. We're getting me and Seneca are getting ready to like do some breakdancing here in the studio. Well, did you bring your cardboard?
No. Have you seen Wild Style lately?
With Lee Quinones, yeah. Right? That was the movie. That was the first like sort of hip hop movie that had breakdancing in it. It had all these hip hop artists.
Right.
And I just
resaw it. The library now has it on DVD.
See, just another reason. There's Seneca the librarian. He's hooking you up.
Yeah, and it's amazing because they've got the shots of Grandmaster Flash at house parties. You know, just in a kitchen with two turntables in front of him, doing his thing, spinning 360s. And
Man, I remember they have in Wild Style, they have like a little like DJs are rapping, and they have a little breakdance contest and a little DJ contest, a little rap contest, and there's Kevy Kev, Waterbed Kev. Oh man, I'm going way back. I'm about to cry, people. This is my childhood.
So yeah, you got to check out that video.
Okay, so you got to check out Wild Style, that movie by Lee Quinone, and he's a graffiti artist and made that movie, and Fab Five Freddy is in it. And also the soundtrack on that one is pretty cool. That's got Busy Bee in it. Ramsey was also in a Jim Jarmusch movie. If you remember that.
No, which
it
one?
Was
in Down by Law?
It was Down by Law, the one with two guys and the girl.
Down by Law is the one with Roberto Benigni in the jail in New Orleans.
Yeah, no, not that one. The one I think before that one.
Oh, Stranger Than Paradise.
Yes, yes. And Ramsey shows up at the end of that one. Okay. So see, look, we're looping it all around. It's like 6 degrees of separation. Everything leads back to hip hop eventually. You got to check this out. And actually, Todd will try to steal that from you too. So you better run out of the studio right now. I'm going to show it to him right now and get the less lustful look. Check that out. Okay, so it's Martha Cooper is the author, and it's Hip Hop Files, Photographs 1979 to 84. I would bust all these photographs out and put them all over my house.
It's an amazing collection.
It's really, really amazing. And it's nicely done, too. Oh, and it's got Wild Style. Oh, Charlie Ahern. That's who it was. Lee Quinones was the guy who produced the movie. Charlie Ahern is the
director.
The director, right. Okay, so tell me about your other books, because this one up here, after we've been talking all this hip-hop stuff, now this book seems like it should be somewhat. It's about addiction.
Yes, it's called America
From
Anonymous.
Happy Times to the Backside.
That's right, the downside of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, America Anonymous is 8 addicts in search of a life, and the author is a sex addict himself. And if you've ever heard sex addiction discussed in most places in the media refer to sex addiction, and suddenly laughter ensues, and it's like, well, sure, I love sex. We're all addicted to sex, et cetera. But he does a really good description in the beginning of what it's like for a sex addict, where you're just obsessed and consumed with thinking about sex all day long. That, you know, and he's a writer, so he'll get up, check his work email, and then not really want to do work and spend 5 hours online in a chat room, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as... you know, he may be engaging in this stuff, but then there's an intense amount of shame afterwards, and you start beating himself up and ready to kill yourself. But then it's such a cyclical thing that it just, in order to stop those bad feelings, you then engage again in whatever your particular addiction of choice is. And this particular book, it's an interesting way that the topic is presented, because there's, I think, 8 addicts in search of a life. 8 different people with different kinds of addiction. So as an author, he has his own, but then there's a heroin addict, a 34-year-old heroin addict, 80-year-old alcoholic, who at age 79 finally accepted intervention.
Wow.
Amazing, yeah. 40-year-old bodybuilder.
I was thinking that when I hit like 79, I was going to try and get myself a prescription drug problem.
Those are acceptable.
Oh, okay. Great. Wow, I thought I was going to have to change my whole life plan.
And there's a person who's addicted to shoplifting. And so it's not just a focus on, say, like one type of addiction or one group of addicts in a therapeutic session or a Addictions Anonymous kind of thing, but it talks about the variety of different things and the similarities in these feelings of obsession and compulsion to act out in these ways in order to compensate for underlying issues that aren't being addressed. And it's quite an interesting look at the things that people will engage in to avoid the pain in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's unpleasant, but it's, you know, one of the things he talks about is how so many other diseases are accepted to be talked about. It's okay to, you know, have a disease and have there be benefits for it, et cetera. But with addictions, many times people may be addicts in recovery, but you don't know about it. It's a so much more private disease. You know, there isn't a, you know, benefits for addiction recovery and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so more people are hiding the fact that they are dealing with this issue, even though they may be currently engaged in being addicted or engaging in addictive behaviors or in a recovery state.
Uh-huh.
It's just not something that is as publicly known as other diseases.
Yeah, that's interesting that there's still that whole layer of shame that's wrapped around the behavior itself and then actually the disengagement from the behavior. Or the reverse, you know, the flip side of that is when you get the person who's just quit smoking, found mm-hmm. Scientology, or lost 150 pounds. Right. Then you can get that person out of your face. Like, dude, do you have a close personal relationship with Jesus Christ, our Savior? It's like, really?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Well, one of the things with addictions is many people have cross addictions, and mm-hmm. they may be able to stop one, but then overcompensate in another area.
Yeah, that's true. Or that, because I think the last time you were here, we talked about that book, The Night of the Gun by David Carr, where right. he talks about, for him, his big problem was first it was powder coke, and then it was crack cocaine. And he said, once he figured that problem out, he thought like, oh, I got this wrapped. And then it turned out, like later on, he relapsed, you know, 14 years into recovery, because he had this sort of simmering alcohol problem that he kind of had never really dealt with the mm-hmm. That, you know, that was the, as one of my friends has said, who himself doesn't drink or do drugs anymore, has said, I always realized that at the bottom of that shot glass was a gram of coke or my coke dealer's phone number. And I was like, wow, dude.
Wow.
I was like, that's like poetic.
Mm-hmm.
And a drag to hang out with you, man, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I bet. No. but I mean, that's true that there's a lot, I think a lot of times when people do, you know, indulge in these behaviors. The thing that I always thought was interesting is how even of the hierarchy of some of these behaviors, you know, like mm-hmm. it's, imagine, you know, when Alcoholics Anonymous started coming out in like, what was in the 50s?
I think so,
when
yeah.
it came out, mm-hmm. where just the whole transformation from this, you know, shame-based thing to a actual, this is an addiction, you know, we can classify this as an addiction.
Right.
And that you can deal with the issue through kind of this at least one of these means of recovery. And okay, so people are more willing to kind of be open about, you know, I'm an alcoholic or I'm in recovery mm-hmm. for alcoholism, but then there's people still wrapped up in shame about other issues. And that, and like you said, the sex addiction one is everyone thinks that's slightly laughable. And
right.
So.
Yeah. And it's, he does reference other books and stuff and talks about, say, cultural aspects of addiction, you know, other countries that may consume alcohol, you know, per capita more than ours may not have the same sense of what is addiction.
And, right.
and you know, at, just looking at this country, there's been a variety of different things that at some times have been classified as addictive drugs and non-addictive. I mean, nicotine, that was all mm-hmm. just fine. You know, was yeah. only in our lifetime that's now this nasty addictive drug.
Uh-huh.
Cocaine was a pharmaceutical.
Oh,
used
I know.
For things. In the 80s, it becomes the most addictive mm-hmm. drug, and we must wipe it out.
Or you know, remember when the crack epidemic, when it was like crack babies. Right. Mothers are leaving their kids on the street for crack cocaine. You see some of the documentaries about mm-hmm. coke and about crack, and it's so, I mean, it is kind of funny to see some of the, especially the newscasters, it's a new epidemic. It's called crack cocaine,
right.
and people are killing each other at Thanksgiving dinner over it. And it was just like, wow, that's really like kind of over the top. But yeah, it is. It's interesting how we're so far. I mean, really, is medicine really still at the stage of leeches?
Well,
I digress.
It's you know, there's the sociopolitical aspect of, you know, what is it that we're trying to control when we say that these drugs are bad
mm-hmm.
and these drugs are okay. And different cultures may be ones that are using drugs more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just we don't have a realistic view of things. You know, we lock people up for drug crimes and so few people actually get into treatment options.
Right.
And really, that's the place that needs where the money needs to go and the focus of society needs to go. People want to get help.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be committing, say, property crimes in order to get meth. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd rather not be doing that.
Yeah, it does seem like in the arc of these stories, at some point, you know, there is, it's what is it? What was it, you know, where you push the button and you get your treat?
Pavlov?
Exactly. Ding. But at some point, you know, you push the button and the treat, it's not as much fun to push the button and get the treat anymore, right?
Right.
So it is, it's kind of, you know, you look at people who are at a stage where they don't want to be addicted to whatever form it is because of the shame that's involved in it. And that is not, you know, those people aren't evil people. Those people are really, you know, those are unhappy people searching for a way out. And when there's no way provided to them, that's pretty sad waste of human potential.
Right, human potential, exactly.
I got to say that this guy has, I think, the sexiest name I have ever heard in my life. Benoit Denisette Lewis. Yes. Benoit. And then you turn the back page and it's like, that guy looks like a frat boy.
I know. That I was very surprised when I looked at that as well.
Dang, Benoit. You start reading about I thought you'd be hotter.
Well, and it's nice to see someone who looks so young to be aware of his addictions and addressing them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and instead, because some of these people that he's talking about for years, they've been dealing with this and they don't, you know, they don't want to be in that cycle. And yet it's the only thing they know. It's the safest thing to do. And it's really hard to break out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I'm looking at these people here where you're describing the addicts that he talks about here. Bobby, heroin, Marvin, alcohol, Todd, crystal meth and steroids. And then you get to Jody, heroin, crack, prescription drugs, gambling, and nicotine. I mean, Jody like hit the trifecta right there, dude. It's like, whoo, that's a lot to work through.
And Jody's a drug and alcohol counselor.
You know, that's the best right there.
Right.
I mean, seriously, I don't even know where, I would have a hard time thinking where you would go if you were digging out of a hole that deep, but mm-hmm. there.
Right.
You know?
Right. It's all you know, and you're trying to help yourself, and if you can help others.
Yeah. I mean, you and me think about it all day anyway, right?
Right.
So do you have any other books for us? Because there was one book that I heard that you brought that got profiled on another show on this radio station.
Yes, there was another show on this radio station.
And it's called what?
I believe they said it was Black Book Club.
No. Yes. I'm turning this into Black Book Club. I will meet you, Black Book Club. I'll meet you in the lobby of KBOO and we will wrestle.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
So they turned me on to this children's book called Barack Obama, Son of Promise, Child of Hope. And the author is Nikki Grimes, mm-hmm. and the illustrator is Brian Collier. And I haven't looked at a children's book in some time. I used to when I worked in a different type of library. I had access to more children's books. Yes. And so it was interesting to see a modern take on a children's picture book, you know, covering a modern story. And it was kind of cute, and I liked it, and it's nice to see this type of book out there. And this was written before he won the election. I think it came out in spring when he had just announced. So that's kind of like the end of it.
Mm-hmm. It's actually a really good looking book.
Yeah, the people who were talking about it on the radio program were very fond of the illustrator.
Mm-hmm. You know, this reminds me of... oh, gosh, now I've totally forgotten it. But it was another Black illustrator who wrote a kid's book, and it's about the Negro Leagues baseball.
Oh, right.
The, and I can't remember. Oh,
paintings.
We Are the Ship.
Yeah, We Are the Ship, yeah.
That is an amazing book. If you can get your hands on that book, buy every copy and give it to people. Because that guy took pictures of Negro League baseball players, you know, either just posed pictures or action mm-hmm. pictures. And then he spent several years doing oil paintings.
Yeah, those paintings are amazing in that book.
I would love to see the exhibit of those paintings that went into this book. And so some of mm-hmm. the art in this book, this Barack Obama book, reminds me of that, some of the artwork in it. It's actually really beautiful.
It is.
And in the back, it's got a little chart, a little genealogical chart.
Yeah, but it's family, isn't that neat?
Family tree from Kansas to Kenya. It's pretty amazing. And that is Barack Obama, Son of Promise, Child of Hope by Nikki Grimes. And the back, check this out. When Barack wasn't studying, he liked to jog along the Hudson River. He couldn't help but notice the river of hurt and hate and history that separated blacks and whites. Being both, he could not take sides. Don't worry, said Hope. I will be your bridge. In time, you will be the bridge for others. Yes, yes, y'all.
There
we're going
go.
Back. We're going to do a full circle of books here.
And how about yourself?
Well, I have a couple of books, but as usual, I'm more lustful of Seneca's books than my books. Can I trade my books for your books?
Look,
I'll give you these two books for that Hip Hop Files book. The librarian doesn't have to know.
Oh, okay.
I actually got this book at the county library, and it's called Barry Bonds, Balco, and the Steroid Scandal. Or it's not called that, but it's about that. It's called Game of Shadows, and it's by Mark Fanaru. I can't even pronounce this guy's name. I screw up every time. Fanaru Wada and Lance Williams. And it basically came out, these guys are San Francisco Chronicle reporters, and they have been reporting about Barry Bonds and Balco and the steroid scandal for a long time, and put mm-hmm. this together in a book. And they actually won some awards for their articles reporting in the San Francisco Chronicle. And it's an amazing book. I mean, it's not just about Barry Bonds. It also revolves a lot around Victor Conte, who is the guy who runs Balco, who was providing steroids to all these different athletes, not mm-hmm. just baseball players, but track and field athletes. And
More about the concept of steroids in sports.
Exactly.
So Game of Shadows
Thank you.
Isn't just
Thank you.
Baseball.
That's why I have the librarian with me, so he can summarize what I'm trying to say in a more linear fashion. But it's a great book because it does have a lot about Barry Bonds. And I am a big baseball fan, and I do not like Barry Bonds. And so after you read this book, you will really, really not like Barry Bonds. He is a very unpleasant person.
Steroids is just one of the issues. I mean, even if he wasn't doing steroids, he doesn't seem to have the same type of team mentality.
No, you know, he is a messed up, unhappy person, which is interesting to me how somebody can be raised in such an atmosphere of privilege. You know, his father,
Bobby Bonds
was...
I love Bobby Bonds.
Yeah. And apparently, you know, what he took from some of that was his father's resentment of how his career was somewhat stifled by... how his father felt his career was stifled by racism. And, mm-hmm. and so Barry sort of took that on himself. But it's like, Barry, you really haven't had those problems, my friend. I mean, you don't really get to come in here and, like, wave the race card all day long. I think you live in a really nice house in San Francisco and have since the day you were born.
He's got quite a prima donna personality in the clubhouse, from what I've heard.
He does. But it's interesting, in this book they talk about when, almost sort of like the whole development of A-Rod, right, of Alex Rodriguez, where, you know, he's always been a stringy, sort of long, lanky player, and then he shows up one spring training, and he's completely turned into something resembling Lou Ferrigno from the Incredible Hulk TV show.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so
you look
it's
at
like
the comparison of photographs.
What? Yeah, and to think that nobody said like, "Wow, what's going on there?" Oh, he's just working out a lot. Really? Wow, he seems angry too. So I would recommend with Game of Shadows. I would also recommend that you look up, so you Google Barry Bonds and check out his history with his. He had a very long and ugly divorce.
Yeah.
With a very poorly written prenuptial agreement. And it is, you know, it's actually quite satisfying to read about how bad things go for Barry. I guess I'm just a player hater today for Barry.
I forgot about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole prenup thing.
God. It's like, wow, that's one not really nice guy. So we're going to get ready to go, but I wanted to let you guys know one more time. We want to thank Todd, and we want to thank you, Todd, for agreeing to go out with us at 11 as opposed to 10:30, and on the third Friday and not the fourth Friday. But I'm going to announce this again, so you got to pay attention, people, because in March, and that's next week, like I said, a lot of the shows from 9 to noon on KBOO during the weekday are going to move to new times. And this show, Boneheads and Bigots, and me, Pat McGuire, and our guests, our special regular guest, Seneca the Librarian, we're all going to be moving to the third Friday of the month at 11 o'clock a.m. So the next time I'm going to be here is Friday, March 20th at 11 a.m. And I want to plug again, go to see Rafael Sadiq, because obviously I can't play, I can't play any of the music for you today because I wore that CD out. But tell us again about the book, Seneca, because before this one disappears from the library.
Okay.
Because I'm going to steal it.
The author will be Martha Cooper, and the book is Hip Hop Files, Photographs 1979 to 1984.
And along with that is Yes, Yes, All, and that is the oral history of hip hop, so you want to check that one out. And then the other thing was the movie
Wild Style,
and that's out there all at your library.
Right, and America Anonymous by Benoit Denizette Lewis, and Barack Obama, Son of Promise, Child of Hope by Nikki Grimes.
And mine was Game of Shadows. And again, I'm sorry, Mark. I'm sorry to be screwing your name up like this. Mark Fanaru-Wada. It's Fainaru-Wada. Wada. And Lance Williams. And that's about Barry Bonds and steroids. So anyway, this has been Boneheads and Bigots. And we're out of here. Me and Seneca are going to go tag some streetcars.
Sup. Sup.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today's Friday, February 27, 2009, and this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Liam Delta. Chris Andre will be joining us live from the Organicology Conference. Portland area weather, today beautiful, sunny with a high near 49, and then tonight mostly clear with a low around 36. Tomorrow increasing clouds and then rain for a while, so enjoy it while you can. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has informally suspended processing clean air and clean water permits for a liquefied natural gas terminal and proposed pipeline on the Columbia River. The DEQ has proposed a formal suspension of permitting until backers of the Bradwood Landing LNG terminal can resolve land use issues with Clatsop County. Otherwise, the agency will be forced to proceed and likely deny the permits. Brett Vandenhoevel with Columbia River Keeper joins us now to talk about the development. Good morning, Brett. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Liam.
So what's going on with this?
Just another major blow to the Bradwood Landing LNG terminal, where they need multiple permits from the state of Oregon to discharge wastewater and polluted air, and the state has, as you mentioned, suspended processing those permits. The really exciting thing is the reason it's a direct result of a referendum that citizens passed in Clatsop County after the leaders there said that they approved the LNG terminals. The citizens reversed that on their own. So it's a really great example of kind of democracy in its truest sense.
Right. And the state is still suing because they did it without state approval, without following the state law?
Yeah, there's a couple levels. The state of Oregon and the state of Washington are both suing the federal government for approving this project. But at the local level, the citizens are still very active in trying to stop it down there on their own.
Yeah. Well, good news, Brett. Thanks for being here. That was
all right,
Brett.
Thank you.
That was Brett Vandenhoevel with the Columbia River Keeper. And now Air Cascadia's Chris Andre is with us again live from the Organicology Conference. Good morning, Chris. Who do you have there to talk to us? Good morning, Chris. Are you there? Okay, we'll get to Chris in just a moment. High school teacher Bill Diss has spent months carrying signs outside Planned Parenthood's regional headquarters growing up in Northeast Portland. He's mobilized protests and testified at public hearings decrying abortion. But when Diss walked away with some signs and banners at the site last year, Planned Parenthood was watching. The group filed a police report and a complaint with the state agency that investigates teacher wrongdoing. That's the scary thing. Diss is a teacher. Okay, Chris is with us live now from the conference. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Liam. I'm at Organicology today speaking with John Benson. John Benson runs Double J Jerseys in Monmouth, Oregon. It's an organic dairy farm. And John is here at the conference. This has various permaculture aspect to it too, and that it's about people and it's about land and it's about growing food. And one of the key bridges, one of the key pieces in that whole formula is farm animals. And John is a dairy farmer here to speak with us this morning.
Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So what do you have for us from the conference today?
I'm just attending and trying to fine-tune my own operation. I have 150 Jersey dairy cows down in Monmouth, Oregon, and we've been grazing cows now for 18 years on our farm and organically producing milk for Organic Valley for 10 years now.
That's great. Is there an increasing demand, or is there a market for the organic milk?
The demand for organic milk has been growing at 20% a year. Consumers have really, really decided that they want their milk produced a different way, and they want their cows treated a different way, and it's been a great, great match for our farm, and the consumers have really been good for us.
That's great. So what are you learning at the conference?
Learning all sorts of interesting things about fertilization, and I've also eventually like to dabble in vegetables, and there's a lot of classes going on about vegetables and the economics of farming.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much, John.
All right. Thank you.
That was John Benson, an organic dairy farmer down in Monmouth, Oregon. A federal appeals court has refused to block plans to trap and kill sea lions that eat endangered salmon at Bonneville Dam. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco ruled that it would not issue a stay sought by the Humane Society of the United States because their arguments are unlikely to prevail as the case moves forward. I wonder what that means. Some Oregon teachers want the legislature to allow them to buy soda pop and unhealthy snack foods in their lounges. Food students are forbidden to purchase on school grounds. The Oregon House gave its approval yesterday, and now that bill goes to the Senate. And Oregon's a dismal report on rising unemployment in Oregon shows that the jobless rate rose up to 9.9% as the state's economy is sinking faster than most others in the nation. January employment numbers for Oregon showed the state lost more than 14,000 jobs. The unemployment rate jumped nearly a full percentage point from December, when Oregon ranked sixth worst in the country. And these numbers don't reflect the thousands of people who have given up and not registered as unemployed. And the number of southern Oregonians using food stamps has climbed to record levels. In Jackson and Josephine counties, January usage increased 20% from a year ago. The department also reported cash assistance to needy families for Jackson and Josephine counties rose 23% from a year ago. The Oregon Senate has approved a bill to set up a kitty for affordable housing. It'll use money from an increase in recording fees for real estate documents. Also, the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department announced it had been awarded a $5 million grant from Chicago-based MacArthur Foundation to help with low-income housing. In Washington state, lawmakers say a possible compromise has emerged on payday lending regulation. This after more than a dozen bills prompted opposition from the check-cashing industry and strong lobbying from consumer advocates. Lawmakers said the compromise would give more protection and choices to customers while avoiding a crippling effect on the industry. The French-owned nuclear services company Areva is scouting northern Idaho to site a plant to turn wood waste into electricity. The plant would be part of a venture outlined earlier this month to develop biomass power plants in Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and Montana. Once again, old Europe leads America. President Obama charted a new course for the nation yesterday with a budget proposing higher taxes for the wealthy and the first steps toward a guaranteed universal health care. This plus a $1.75 trillion federal deficit, nearly four times the highest in history. Obama unveiled his own $3.6 trillion blueprint for next year, a proposal that would transfer wealth from rich taxpayers to the middle class and the poor, but congressional approval without major change is unlikely. KBOO's Spencer Raymond joins us now to talk about President Obama's risky business. Good morning, Spencer.
Good morning, Liam. Yeah, you said it. It is risky business, and you know, as his as he becomes president for longer, he's facing bigger decisions. And each day when he makes these announcements, he just announced today that he gave a strong deadline for troops coming back from Iraq. He's doing things. He's working with his team in the White House to try to get this economy back going. The one thing, increasing taxes for wealthier part of Americans. There's a big wealth distribution, excuse me, in this country, and by taxing those higher earners, he's hoping to help pay for these programs that he's proposing.
But it's unlikely that this will get through unchanged. Do you see it maintaining, keeping its main thrust as it goes through the Congress?
Yeah, and that's the thing. That's what we saw earlier this week when Obama gave his address to the Congress. Is all he can do is direct, and when it comes down to it, it's going to be the House, it's going to be the Senate, just like we saw with the large stimulus bill from last week. They are the ones who are going to be crafting it, negotiating, and that's when the Republicans come into play. And there were three Republican senators who ended up agreeing with the Democrats to vote that stimulus through. And so as much as Obama would love to be bipartisan and work with both sides of the aisle, all he can do is really ask for it. It's up for the lawmakers on Capitol Hill to actually engage in those across-aisle negotiations and to get something worked out between the two that can actually work. And again, I mean, Obama can say, let's raise taxes, let's, you know, pull troops out, let's, you know, do all this stuff. But when it comes down to, he can only sign it after Capitol Hill pushes it through. And this is a new kind of politics we're seeing, I think, because there's so much direction coming right now from the president. And the House and Senate are kind of falling in lockstep, and they have their own ideas and such. But so far, it's basically been exactly what Obama has asked for, what the Congress has been giving him.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Spencer.
Thank you, Liam.
That was KBOO Spencer Raymond with DC Dirt, everything that gets swept under the rug. And now some international stories. At this point, it looks like the Obama administration's policy toward Venezuela is pretty much decided, and the embargo on Cuba is considered untouchable because no one will risk losing support among Cuban Americans in Florida. That leaves Bolivia as a left government in the region where the hostility of the Bush administration could be reversed. So Bolivia is safe for now. Wait, maybe not. This is from the BBC. The water wars are coming, scream the headlines. It seems obvious rivalries over water have been the source of disputes since humans started cultivating food. Even our language reflects those ancient roots. Rivalry comes from the Latin rivalis, two people using the same river. As the impact of water scarcity has grown, so have the warnings that countries will take up arms to ensure access to water. Per Fogering has an interesting interview on this subject, which will be posted on the KBOO website by tonight. In a swift about-face from her views as New York senator, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now hammering Israel over its treatment of Palestinians in Gaza. In February 2000, when she was courting New Yorkers, Clinton said, quote, "I'm a very strong supporter of Israel." Yesterday, as Secretary of State, she had another about-face in the form of angry messages demanding Israel speed up aid to Gaza. American Jewish leaders are not happy. Democratic Representative Tom Amiano has called for marijuana to be regulated and taxed in the state of California. His plan has been roundly condemned by anti-drug activists. Amiano believes that a regulatory system similar to the one used for alcohol, with sales restricted to people aged 21 and over, would be best. He says that regulation would create revenue and destroy the black market. This has been news from Air Cascadia for Friday the 27th of February, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Todd Wilson. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta, and Chris Andre will be back in the studio Monday. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you, members. Coming up next is Flashpoints, increasing pressure on Attorney General Eric Holder to prosecute Bush administration officials for war crimes. And remember, Air Cascadia will be heard an hour earlier starting Monday. Air Cascadia will be at 10 o'clock weekday mornings starting Monday. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
On Flashpoints, internationally renowned Middle East reporter Robert Fisk talks about Afghanistan, Iraq, and the recent press continues to fail in covering these stories. Also, dozens of organizations release a statement urging Attorney General Eric Holder to appoint a special counsel to investigate alleged crimes of the Bush administration. And the Night Report. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And now from exile in New York City, the Night Report with Robert Knight.
In today's Night Report, human rights at Guantanamo and Bagram. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Attorney General Eric Holder says the announced closing of the U.S.-operated Guantanamo Gulag could take the better part of a year. He said the administration wants to do case-by-case reviews of the nearly 300 international abductees still remaining there, quote, until we get our hands around what Guantanamo is and also what Guantanamo was, end quote. Following a pre-scheduled official visit to Guantanamo earlier this week, Holder made the unsurprising declaration overnight that, quote, I did not witness any mistreatment of prisoners. I think to the contrary, what I saw was a very conscious attempt by these guards to conduct themselves in an appropriate way, end quote. However, Holder's rosy picture of the Guantanamo prison differs greatly from that of attorney Ahmed Gapur of the human rights organization called Reprieve. Gapur says that according to his 36 clients, there has been more torture and abuse since President Obama was inaugurated because, he says, quote, low-level guards are just basically trying to get their kicks in right now for fear that they won't be able to do so later, end quote. Among the abuses Gapur enumerated were the forced feeding of hunger strikers with laxatives to induce chronic diarrhea, the pepper spraying of toilet papers for hemorrhoidal inmates, knee, shoulder, and thumb dislocations, beatings intended to discourage meetings with lawyers, and the substitution of false IDs by guards to deter investigation of prisoner complaints. The administration's plan to close Guantanamo is counterbalanced by the maintenance of the United States' other gulag in Afghanistan, the super prison at Bagram Air Base, where nearly 1,000 abductees are currently being held following their capture or rendition. The European Union is meanwhile warning Washington not to merely transfer human rights violations from Cuba to Afghanistan. A confidential EU policy paper obtained by Reuters says Europe will not cooperate with operations at Bagram without guarantees of due process. And finally, the issue of torture at Guantanamo and Bagram could soon come before the U.S. Senate, with reports that Judiciary Chair Pat Leahy is contemplating hearings and the formation of a congressional commission on torture. Leahy proposed an as-yet-unformed South African-style truth or torture commission with subpoena power and witness immunity, except for perjury, even though some legislators would prefer criminal prosecutions for torture. A Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on the subject is currently scheduled for next Wednesday. And that's some of the news of this Thursday, February 26, 2009. From Exile in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're delighted to be joined again by Robert Fisk, award-winning reporter for the Independent of London, based in Beirut, Lebanon, author of a number of books, including the very substantial The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. And this man knows more about what's been going on in the region than probably anybody alive today. Robert Fisk, welcome back to Flashpoints. We have here a new president, Obama. We haven't spoken to you since. Let's start by taking a look at what he seems to be doing in Afghanistan, which is expanding a war